This is an interview with Dr. Barbara Kidman for the University of Adelaide Oral History Project on the 14th of November 2005. Interviewer Rob Lynn. This is session one. Barbara, you were born in 1927. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents, please?
Yes. My father was at that time a station manager. We lived on a sheep station called Oakden Hills, which is up near Woomera. He came from a country family, many of whom were bushmen, I would say. My father in his younger years was a bushman who worked for his uncle. And then after the First World War, he and his brothers purchased Oakden Hill Station. My mother was a nurse whose forebears also had been bush people, but she'd grown up in Adelaide, and because her parents died when she was young, she had to earn a living, so she followed her older sister's advice and took up nursing, was trained at the Royal Adelaide Hospital. And she met my father at Kapunda. My father's family home was at Kapunda, and his sister Jean was nursing at the Kapunda Hospital. After my mother finished her training, she worked there, and so she met Jean Kidman, and hence my father.
Your father was Thomas?
Thomas Kidman.
And he was a nephew of Sir Sidney?
Nephew of Sir Sidney Kidman.
And your mother's Christian name, Barbara?
And my mother's Christian name was Letitia. Neither of them had middle names, which is rather curious. And she was always called Letty.
And she'd been at Conway, is that correct?
Conway was her maiden name. And her father, Archibald Conway, was a pioneer. He came out to Adelaide from Ireland because his sister was married to a man who had a property to the south of Adelaide, and that family are buried in the St Mary's Church Cemetery. And my mother's mother was the Fanny Burt, Frances Burt, and her father had come out to South Australia in 1839, and he was not a prominent but a fairly prominent Adelaide citizen of the day.
That was Adam George Burt.
Adam George Burt.
He'd been a surveyor, is that right?
Yes, he was a surveyor on the Overland Telegraph, and we suspect that that was how the Conways came in contact with them, because Archibald Conway was the manager of Peak Station, which is in the north of South Australia, at the time the Overland Telegraph went through. And the headquarters, the South Australian headquarters of the Overland Telegraph construction party, were at Peak Station. There are various geographical features around Alice Springs that have been named after both Archibald Conway and Adam George Burt. There's Burt Springs, Burt Bluff, and there's a Mount Conway in the Western MacDonald Ranges.
So your mother, being a nurse, had gone into a career which wasn't what many young women did at the time?
Not many, but there were women who did nursing, yes, that was unusual, and I feel it had a subtle effect on me, because she loved her job as a nurse, and of course had to give it up when she married, but had very happy memories of her time as a nurse.
Barbara, what are your earliest memories of living at Oakden Hills?
Well, I can remember the house and the people who worked there. There were lots of men working there. I can remember lots of incidents there. we had a rather unusual family life because we lived in a small house that didn't have a kitchen, and our meals were brought up to us from the main kitchen on a tray. There was a cook employed who cooked both for us and for the men who worked at the station. It was called a married couple. They had a man whose job was to milk the cow and kill the sheep or whatever for meat, and do various odd jobs, any gardening that was done, grow some vegetables. And his wife did the cooking with his assistants. Made bread once a week, I think. So we only had fresh bread once a week.
Was it beautiful country up there?
I love it. I've been back a number of times. It's fairly flat bush country, very, very dry. I mean, you don't get beautiful scenery, but the bush itself, I think, is very, very beautiful.
Did your mother and father consider education an important part of your life?
Yes, they did. I have to give them credit for that. My brother and I had correspondence school lessons, and we received the lessons by post once a week on the tea and sugar train, and sent off our work once a week, the following week. And my parents supervised us. Both of them really had primary education, but I think primary education involved more than it does now. Of course, my mother was a trained nurse, but they were both very well-read people, and they had no difficulty teaching us to the stage I went to. Till I was 10, I had correspondence school lessons, and we were well ahead with our academic work when we went to school.
Yeah, your brother is?
Peter, and he went on the land too, and he is a successful businessman, I would say.
Yeah, is he younger than you? Or
a year younger than I am.
So after this pretty successful correspondence school system, what happens to your schooling after that?
Well, we left Oakton Hills partly because of our education, because my parents believed that we had to go to school and they didn't want us to leave home. And Oakton Hills was sold, and my father looked for another property because that was the way he had to earn his living. And we were itinerant for about a year, and I went to school at Henley Beach School for a few months, and also at a school near Cow, and at Port Augusta School. First we went to Port Augusta School.
And after that, does the family settle at Port Lincoln?
Yes, we settled at Port Lincoln.
And what school did you attend there?
I attended a small one-teacher school, North Shields School, which had about 20 children there. And I went to that school for 2 years. I think there were all seven grades in the one room. And the teachers were very, very good, particularly the teacher I had in the second year. He managed it all terribly well, and he taught lots of extracurricular activities besides the sums and English spelling and English and so on. He taught everything. I thought he was a fantastic teacher.
What was his name?
His name is Rex Williams. I still know him. And he actually influenced me a lot because he encouraged me to be ambitious.
In a scholastic sense?
In a scholastic sense. Mm. And he set my sights higher than they had been. definitely. It was very difficult because we were in this little school, and of course at the end of that year I had to do the QC, the qualifying exam, and to do that we had to go into Port Lincoln, which was 5 miles away, not very far by present day standards, but it was quite an ordeal for a child of 12 to have to go and do an exam in a strange school. Seemed a bit unfair to me, but but anyway, I did it and got through the QC, won a scholarship, and went to Port Lincoln High School after that.
And the scholarship was for?
I think there were fees at high school in those days, and I think it probably paid the fees and gave a living allowance of some sort. I can't be sure of the details, for 3 years, I think.
So your family were living out North Shields Way?
Yes, we were living 5 miles north of Port Lincoln, 1.5 miles south of North Shields, and all of these places are on Boston Bay. So our farm property was in the most beautiful location with the most beautiful view over the harbour, and it was a very, very beautiful property, and the hills behind were lovely, and we had a private beach virtually.
So Port Lincoln High School, did that continue the high quality of education you experienced at North Shields?
It was mixed. It was mixed. On the whole, I think the teaching was very good, very good. And certainly the science teaching was very good. I was very lucky again because the head master of the high school at that time was a man called Simmons, who I think is well known in the education department. And he, for the very first time, he allowed girls to do physics and chemistry. So in my second year, I was able to do physics and chemistry, which hadn't been permitted up until then. And so I got into the solid science stream, and excellent teachers, they were all men, but very, very good maths, physics and chemistry teaching.
Yeah, Mr. Simmons is very well known.
Yes.
He was, I think today they'd probably call him one of the superheads or whatever the term is.
Well, he was willing to try new things, I think, and he was very good to me and to some of my co-students at the school.
Was it a large school, Barbara?
Fairly large. I can't tell you the number, but I think it was. And I think the standards were pretty high. I mean, it was mixed, of course. There weren't very many of these students who were academically ambitious, but there were some, which was good. And as a matter of fact, one of the... I was there for 3 years, and I still... have a friend that I made at that school. Our lives have diverged, but she lives in Sydney and we see each other at least once a year, I'd say. And we've remained friends all our lives, so that's quite amazing, really.
That is, isn't it?
Mm.
So after those 3 years, you come to Adelaide, to Walford?
That's right, yes.
And why were you sent to Walford? Was that to prepare you for university or what?
Not really, because technically I was able to go to the university after my 3 years at Port Lincoln, because I'd done an accelerated course there. In my second year, I sat for the intermediate exam. They gave me the opportunity, and I thought, oh, well, I might as well sit for the exam. And I did well, sufficiently well for me to be moved up to the leaving, and at that stage... the leaving was the matriculation, so technically I could have gone to the university, but I don't think my parents thought I was mature enough, and my mother very much wanted me to go to she chose Wolford because a great friend of hers had sent her daughters to Wolford, and she thought it would help socially, I think, to go to Wolford.
Well, in those days, was Wolford House in the same location as it is today?
Yes, it was. Mm.
But it was pretty much the two-storey building, was it?
Well, that was the boarding house. There were schoolrooms, and there was a hall there. I think they've built a much bigger hall now, but none of the teaching was done in the two-storey building.
That was in the single-storey house, was it?
No, the teaching was done in...
Oh, in the classrooms.
In classrooms.
Yes, no, sorry, I'm with it now.
Yes.
So, Barbara, but your education there was mixed also.
It was mixed. I mean, actually, the science, the maths teaching was not good because I was doing leaving honours, and the maths teaching was not good. The chemistry, we had practical in at the School of Mines, and that really saved me because that was very good teaching. And I did physics in at the School of Mines. That was very good teaching, but the maths and the chemistry classes were very poor. English was excellent, and botany was very, very good. They were very good teachers, so it was mixed.
Mm-hmm. Now, the subjects you did at the Adelaide Technical High School would have formed the basis of your future study, is that right?
Yes, I mean, I'm not sure whether it was Adelaide Technical High School. I'm not sure what the arrangement was, whether it was actually School of Mines or Adelaide Tech. I'm not even sure that Adelaide Tech did leaving honours, did they? I don't know. I'm not sure, but all I know is that it was arranged from the school. The class, the chemistry practical, there weren't many girls going to that class, but the physics was done for girls from independent schools. And so there were girls from all the main independent schools in Adelaide were combined in one class and taught physics.
How large was the class, Bart?
I would have said 20 or so.
Hmm.
Mm. We did physics, the practical and the... They were lecture-style teaching, too. It was lecture-style teaching.
Mm. Now, how did you go in the Leaving Honours examinations?
I did quite well. I got a high credit in physics. I don't think I got a credit in chemistry, and I got a high credit in botany.
So that gave you the ability to... to go to tertiary education?
Oh, well, yes. I already had the ability because I'd matriculated. But I guess it gave me, you know, more confidence.
Now, what led you towards the Bachelor of Science? Was that just your interests?
I think it was. I was torn between science and medicine. And as a matter of fact, there was... some family pressure on me to do medicine, not so much from my parents but from an uncle. But I decided to do science because I was anxious to sort of get on and get out in the world, and I thought, oh, I don't know whether I want to spend 6 years studying. That's what I thought then. And after all, in those days, you could change from science to medicine. So I thought I postponed the decision until the end of my first year.
Was the uncle a Kidman or a Conway?
He was neither. He was married to a Kidman. Mm. Mm.
And he felt this was the important way to go, obviously.
Obviously he did, yes.
So buoyed up by your natural instincts and... talents, Barbara, you begin at Adelaide University in 1945. What was it like as a place?
It was great fun. It was a wonderful experience, I thought, going to university. I liked it much better than school. I was enthusiastic about work. And of course, having done Leaving Honours, the first year was very easy. It was possible to get exemptions from some first year subjects on the basis of Leaving Honours results, and I could have had an exemption from Physics 1, but I chose not to. And so I went ahead and did the course, and really there was a certain amount of overlap. So I found first year university extremely easy academically, and so that gave me time to do other things, and I really started to participate fairly fully in extracurricular activities at the university.
Can you tell me about some of those, please?
Well, I joined the Student Christian Movement, and that was really a great organisation. It was the basis of most of my social life at the university, I would say, because we had lots of activities, went away on camps, went on bushwalks, and we met people from other disciplines, students from other disciplines and from different first year, second year, third year, everyone, postgraduate students. So you met a wide range of students through the SCM. It was a great place. It was very liberal then in its approach to Christianity too. It was a very broad-based organisation. So it was good. And I also joined I was very active in the Science Association. And later on I got into student politics. Not so much in first year, but after that, second year.
And you actually eventually were on the SRC.
Yes, I was.
Yeah. Mm. Barbara, can you tell me a little about the lectures in the first year? Where were they held and who were the lecturers, perhaps?
Yes. The maths lectures, I think, were held in the Prince of Wales Lecture Theatre, which a building that doesn't exist now. It was behind the Mitchell Building. And the lecturers were very, very good. There were two lecturers who were former school teachers. In fact, I think all the staff of the maths department were former school teachers when I was there. And Mr. Gray and Mr. Statton, Joe Statton, and they were very good teachers. I don't think they did any research, but they were very, very good teachers. And Gray was an amazing man. He was quite an inspirational teacher, I would say. So,
is he G-R-E or A-Y? A-Y. And he was inspirational?
Yes. He was a very good teacher. I suppose he was a school teacher, but I think he was inspirational. Mm. And the physics lectures were shocking. We had Kerr Grant, Professor Kerr Grant. And these lectures were held in what is now called the Kerr Grant Lecture Theatre, a great big lecture theatre in the physics building. And they were really a bit of a riot. I mean, the girls all sat at the front and they knitted, and attendance at lectures was compulsory, and the roll was passed around the class for you to sign, and of course all sorts of forgeries were done on the roll. And he was a bit of a showman. He did lots of practical demonstrations that were meant to demonstrate points in physics, but often went wrong, and the whole thing was a riot. In fact, I don't know how anyone could pass Physics 1 from attending those lectures. A lot of students went also to the evening, including myself, went to evening classes as well. So we had to attend the morning lectures because attendance was compulsory. And so I used to go to the, I suppose they were, I don't know whether they were 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. I think they might have been four. But that was a bit of a nuisance, having to go to two sets of lectures. The lectures given in the evening were by a man called Fuller, George Fuller, and he just gave solid physics lectures. They were perfectly clear and reasonably well presented. Now, what are the... Were
well, Kerr Grant, physically, was quite an unusual-looking character.
He was. He was a character. He really was a character, and I mean, I had very unfortunate experiences later. I mean, when I did second year physics, I remember he gave this course on electromagnetism. I just couldn't make head nor tail of it. He was always making mistakes. He wrote all over the blackboard, and he was a very, very poor blackboard technique. And he'd often make mistakes. He'd work out I suppose you'd call it a theorem, some mathematics, and then he wouldn't get the right answer. So he'd know, he'd try to correct it, and he wouldn't be able to. And it was not systematically given in any way whatsoever. And I really thought I'd have to give up because I couldn't make sense, and then I discovered a textbook. So I just taught myself from a textbook. So it was much, he was a very, very poor lecturer. And when I was doing honours physics, he wasn't there when I started. Honours students had to start early. And at the beginning of February, I think, and when I turned up, the reader in physics, who was Dr. Roy Burden, gave me a perfectly good project to work on, which I worked on for a month, practical project. And then when Kerr Grant came back, he reallocated all the projects. And it was very much the days of the God professor. And Roy Burden was a man who hadn't fared well under that system. And anyway, so I had to start again. And although the project he gave me was an interesting one, I didn't get any supervision from him. It was just left to me, really. No one supervised me for my honours project.
So you were very much thrown on your own devices?
Well, I suppose we were. One of the other funny things about doing honours physics was that you had to have a reading knowledge of German, because German was supposedly the scientific language of the time. So every morning, I think at 9 o'clock, or three mornings a week at 9 o'clock, the honours class went into Kerr Grant's office and were given lessons in German by Kerr Grant. Well, they were hardly lessons. It was, he'd read a bit of German to us. I think he spoke and could read German. And they were an absolute riot. And what we had to do then was to translate a paper. We were given a fairly long scientific paper in German, which we had to translate into English, which I had a pretty long one, and I did it, but I wasn't fluent in German, because I'd learnt some German at school. I did intermediate German at school. So he wasn't an academic leader, I don't think. He was a hopeless lecturer, and he didn't do any research, as far as I know. And I mean, virtually no research was done in the physics department then. And the other physics lecturers were not very good either, so. It's amazing, really, that we all got through.
What about the other subjects you took?
Excuse me.
Okay.
Mm.
Barbara, what about the other subjects that you were doing in the science degree?
Yes, I did chemistry, of course, and it never appealed to me, chemistry. I think it's probably because I had such poor teaching in leaving honours, but it was so-so, I would say, the teaching in first-year chemistry. We had good practical classes. So I would say it was sort of an average teaching. I also did a subject that was really biology. I did one, it consisted of one term of botany and two terms of zoology. And the botany lecturing was good, but it duplicated what I'd done in leaving honours. The zoology, I think, is worth commenting on, because the lecturer for most of the time was Professor Harvey Johnson, who's quite a significant historical figure in the university, because he went on Mawson's last shipboard expedition to Antarctica. He went on board the ship as a zoologist, and so he's quite well known in that regard. But the lectures were extraordinary because he read the lectures. They were all read from written transcript. And one of the undergraduates had them duplicated. It was quite enterprising, really, because we didn't have photocopiers then. And he sold so he could buy a copy of the lectures. And when the course was being given, if he departed at all from the lecture notes, you could hear the reaction in the class, because they were all following these lecture notes. So they weren't in, I guess it was solid enough material, but very uninteresting, because it was being read. And the practical classes were good in zoology. And I did come in, I think she may have given us some lectures too, was one of Sir Douglas Mawson's daughters, Pat Thomas, was a lecturer in zoology, and she was a very good teacher, I'd say, both as a lecturer and supervisor of the practical demonstrator. So it was interesting. That was when I first came across her.
Well, Pat would have been an enthusiast, I suppose.
She was. She was quite a fiery personality. But I think a very interesting person.
Any other lecturers that stand out to you in your courses?
In second year I did statistics, and I had Alan James, who was a young statistician, and he later became Professor Alan James, and he was all right as a lecturer. I mean, he obviously had a very solid background and knew what he was talking about, and it was an innovation. It was the first time any undergraduate lectures had been given in that subject, statistics. It was meant to be it was statistical method, so it was given to help scientists who had to use statistics. It was very, very easy for someone like me who had some mathematical ability. It was a combination. I actually had five subjects in second year. It was a funny arrangement. I did physics two, and then this combination subject, they were like half subjects, statistical methods and physical chemistry, which was the part of chemistry that I was most interested in. And then to do maths, you had to do applied maths and pure maths. So sort of had two separate subjects. So probably two lectures a week, I've forgotten. But it was quite a lot of work having all these five different things for which you were had weekly exercises and lectures to attend and so on. The maths lecturers were Gray and Sanders, I think. He was a solid lecturer. By then he was professor of maths. He was a man who'd been educated at Cambridge. I don't think he did any research, but he was a very proper person. And all the lecturers knew the students, particularly if you were a girl, because after first year I was the only girl in Physics 2, and I think one of about three in the maths subject. So everyone knew us, and all the lecturers knew us. And a funny thing used to happen after exams, when they were marking exams, the lecturers would often tell you that you were doing well or something. It was very strange. They gave you a sort of running commentary on what was happening in the marking. So that was something that when I became a lecturer would never have happened.
Was that an indicator of the size of the institution at the time?
I suppose, and the informality of it. Everything was very informal. Although, I mean, students behaved well and in classes, and I mean, always called lecturers Mr. or Doctor or Professor, and were very respectful of the academic staff. But I also the undergraduates often got to know some of the demonstrators, you know, in chemistry and physics quite well. And they were often terribly helpful because they were very approachable. And I found the demonstrators in physics a huge help.
Were they younger people?
Yes, young people who, you know, only been graduated a few years, but they were always very enthusiastic and, of course, pretty bright people. And if you had problems, you could ask them. So they were very helpful.
Barbara, you paint a picture of a place where there's a large accent on teaching but not a lot on research in the sciences. Was that pretty much the way?
I think so.
Barbara, we were talking about the mix between research and teaching at the university at the time you were there, and it does appear that teaching had it.
Yes, well, of course, when you're an undergraduate, you don't really have insight into what's happening within departments, but I think the university was pretty dead. I'm sure there were exceptions to that. I'm sure there was some research being done behind the scenes. As far as I know, there wasn't any in physics, which was the department that I knew well, and I'm certain there wasn't any in maths. So those two were the departments that I had most contact with, and there was no research being done in either of them.
Barbara, I know that you did well academically, but on another level, being a long way from home, how did you cope boarding out or whatever you did at the time?
It was difficult. It was very difficult. St Anne's College wasn't available then, and I spent most of my undergraduate years living with family friends, very close family friends, where I shared a bedroom, and where I would say the family didn't understand just how much work you had to do when you were at university. So I found the studying conditions very difficult. I was happy enough living with them. They were very kind to me and I felt part of the family. But I did quite a lot of studying at the university or in the public library.
What was the Barsmith Library like at that time?
Oh, it was great. A lot of people studied there, and there was that big reading room. So I spent many, many hours in the reading room. And during SWATVAC, there weren't so many students there then in Swatvak because they were all at home. But we all, there was a sort of convention that you broke off for morning coffee and went over and bought a coffee at the refectory. So it was quite a camaraderie about the students who were studying at the university. I think when you got to honours, you could get a carrel. There were these study areas downstairs, and you could get one of your own if you're an honours student. I didn't have one. I think you had to be an art student or a maths, but you couldn't. I don't think it was available to me. But because no one uses them now.
These are the enclosed rooms.
Yes, they're sort of semi-enclosed little places. They were called carrels, and I knew several people who had them.
Barbara, you mentioned going to the refectory. What were the Union and the Cloisters area like?
Oh, it was, I suppose, essentially, as it is now, the centre part of the Cloisters was lawn. It wasn't paved like it is now. And it was pretty busy at lunchtime. I think most people took their own lunch, but everyone gathered there. And people, well, maybe it was because of my contact with SCM and Science Association and so on, but everyone went there and had their lunch. So we all had lunch together. It was a very friendly sort of atmosphere, and a great opportunity to talk to people from other disciplines. And you could buy a roll in the refectory. Of course, there weren't all the other eating houses then. It was just the ground floor refectory. And so in some ways it's like it is now, but I would say much friendlier and probably much more used than it is now. If I go down to the university now around sort of lunchtime, seem to be more people out on the Barsmith lawns, although they were used too. But the area in the cloisters was a hive of activity.
Did you mentioned the clubs and societies you were involved with. Was there a sporting side to that as well in the Union?
Oh yes, the sport was much the same as it is now, I'd say, and they ran all the sports, and I wasn't a great sports person, but I did play netball. It was called basketball then. I did play netball in university women's teams. I was down near the bottom somewhere, and I also played. There was a social tennis club out where using the tennis courts by the oval. And that they played on Saturdays. I used to play social tennis.
So those uni oval courts, there were three or four of them together by the grandstand. Are they the ones you met?
Yeah, well, they were on the south side of the oval.
Yes, they're the ones.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yes, yes. And
best courts in Adelaide.
Yeah. Well, it was. I suppose they had teams as well, but. I think it was Saturday afternoons we used to play, because there are other tennis courts that in the parklands off McKinnon Parade that the university has too, but they weren't there then. When I was an undergraduate, it was just these courts on the oval.
Barbara, you're obviously delighted in university life. Can you tell me a bit about third year? Because you did say to me that third year academically there were just a few blips.
There were, because I think I was doing Physics 3, Applied Maths 3 and Pure Maths 3. So the two Pure Maths counted as one subject. So that was a fairly heavy load, I think. And I was on lots of committees, and in particular on this SRC, I'm not sure that it was called SRC then, I forget what it was called, but I was on this committee, and in a typical undergraduate procedure, we decided to rewrite the Constitution. And there was a subcommittee of three people that rewrote the constitution, and I was one of those three. And we met almost every lunch hour and spent hours doing this, and probably it lasted about 10 years, and then they rewrote it again, I'd say. But it was a very, very time-consuming thing, and it did have an effect on my work. It was a distraction.
Why did the Constitution need rewriting?
I can't remember why. I mean, the university was slowly becoming more democratic, of course. And the three people who were on the committee were Ralph Parsons, who was an engineering student, and he later became professor of physics at University of Queensland. And the other one was a chemist, trying to think of his name, and he went to work in England for at Harwell, and then he worked, I think, for the Atomic Energy Commission in Sydney. I've just forgotten his name. They were both older than I was, but of course we had to have the token female on the subcommittee, which was me.
Were women beginning to have more of a life at university?
Oh, I think undergraduate women have always had a life at university. They've always been fairly active. One of the interesting things was that the Lady Simon building, of course, was for women, and the George Murray building for men. There were halls on the ground floor where meetings were held, but the upstairs of the basement were washrooms, and the upstairs rooms were meant either for women or men. But I remember when I got on this SRC committee, all the meetings were held in the George Murray, so I got to go to see the George Murray building, which I hadn't seen, hadn't ever been up the stairs until my third year. I mean, women undergraduates were quite prominent in the university, but of course in the science subjects there was a majority of men, and maths and physics, very few women. Very few.
Barbara, were you the first woman to do honours physics?
Yes, I was the first woman to do honours physics.
Do you recall how you came to be invited to do it?
Well, I think it was sort of automatic. I was invited to do it because I did very well in third year. So I did do well in third year physics, but not in the maths. So I mean, there was never any suggestion that you couldn't do it. It was always permitted, and I mean, I was always given equal opportunity over everything as an undergraduate. I was certainly allowed to do it. The only thing I would say is that everyone thought it was a great thing for a girl to do honours physics in the physics department, but the suggestion was that they needed women school teachers. And so the idea was that I would then become a teacher.
So a woman academic was a very unusual thing, I suppose, in the sciences.
I think it was pretty unusual in anything. I mean, there were women academics, but they always held junior positions. I don't think there were... As an undergraduate, I didn't have... I mentioned Pat Mawson, may have given a few lectures in Zoology 1. I don't remember having a woman in botany, I can't be sure of that. But for the rest of my 4 years at university, I didn't have a single woman lecturing.
Mm.
I don't think there were any women demonstrators in physics or chemistry. There were in the biological sciences. So it's They were pretty scarce.
Barbara, can I ask you to reflect on this immediate post-war time? Because the Commonwealth retraining scheme comes into it too, doesn't it?
It very much did.
So there must have been a very large influx of particularly young men who'd been in the armed forces in some way. Would you like to talk about that?
Yes. It had a very significant effect on the university. In fact, someone was telling me recently that, in fact, it doubled the population of the university. Now, they, by and large, I would say they had a very good effect on the university because they were very mature. And certainly in my area, in physics and maths, they worked very hard and they were very good, the students that came. I think they worked much harder than the other undergraduates did. And in physics, they were a huge competition to me personally because there were a group of about four of them who worked a lot together. And it was pretty tough to be competing with them. They were nice, very nice people. I think they... there were some of them, perhaps, who weren't as mature, but they did. University was a serious place for them. So not many of these CRTS trainees took an active part in extracurricular activities, I would say.
Well, were they, I guess today we'd use the term driven, by their experiences, they wanted to get on and get moving?
Oh, I think they were older and they, a lot of them were married, and so they were under sort of financial pressure, I would say. Although they were well paid, well supported at the university, they were all anxious to get on with life, I think. That would be my impression of them. A couple of these men I know very well. I know they're family friends, and that's how I would interpret it. They, some of them, of course, had a unique opportunity. There were people who wouldn't have ever come to university if they hadn't had this opportunity, and it's really amazing what had opened up for them, because two of the Adelaide CRTS trainees became professors of mathematics. So that's pretty remarkable, really. And they were both people who wouldn't have gone on to university if it hadn't been for the war.
Barbara, I can think of at least one, if not three, lawyers who would never have gone to university who became senior partners and very senior legal figures too.
Mm.
Just seemed to be, if you like, the thanks that the nation gave to those people also gave an impetus to those who would never have got a look in.
I agree with that. I think perhaps times have changed and now educational opportunities are there that didn't exist before the war. See, I think I was fortunate, really, that I was given the opportunity.
Did you have a scholarship? I meant to ask you that.
Yes, I did. I had a scholarship. I got a leaving, it was called a leaving bursary. The leaving bursary was means tested. And I've forgotten how many were given statewide. It was either 24 or 48. It may have been 48. And what did I have forgotten? Did I get 4 credits in the leaving? Did 7 subjects and got 4 credits. And I won a bursary. And I was, my parents' income allowed me to get that bursary, which exempted me from university fees and also had a living allowance if you lived away from home. So it was very useful to me, or to my family. It would have been much harder if to. It was much harder to get a leaving honours bursary because there were only 12 in the state.
Mm.
I don't think I would have got one.
Would it have been difficult for your parents to send you to university on any other basis?
I think it would have. Mm.
Mm. So, in effect, you had that unique opportunity.
Yes. Mm.
For, well, not quite unique, but that opportunity.
Mm. It's more difficult when you live in the country because just the fees at university aren't the only cost. You know, there are lots of the travel costs and the cost of living away from home. So that makes it more difficult.
Barbara, did you really enjoy the honours physics year? So this is, we're getting towards your final year at university. Was that an enjoyable time, or did the things we talked about earlier make it less enjoyable?
I think it was enjoyable. I separated myself from the extracurricular activities. I didn't do much around the union in my honours year, and but I had lots of friends by then. So at the university, even though they weren't doing physics, that didn't seem to matter. And I found it was a very my fellow students were always very supportive. And I must say, I take my hat off to them. I was the only girl, and there were 9 young men, and they treated me very equally, I thought. They treated me well. So I think I enjoyed it. It was pretty hard. I had to work very hard. But I enjoyed it. I found it very interesting. It was, again, it was Kerr Grant. He was still the professor of physics. And we were given a very impossible curriculum, really, for honours. We had this very thick textbook by a German called Jos that used an unusual kind of mathematics that was pretty hard to follow, and that was the basis of most of our exam. There were some things that weren't in the textbook, but I think everyone who did that honours year has kept their copy of Jos, because it was a terrible book and very difficult. But anyway, we all got through, and some of us got firsts.
Was there a thesis component also?
Well, I mentioned this practical, yes, there was. And I've no idea of the proportion. We weren't told, you know, we weren't given any details of our results, only the overall result. But I can't remember. I don't remember writing a thesis, but I must have. I haven't got it. In the end, although I was critical of Kerr Grant, it proved to be quite an interesting thing because it was in modern physics. It was on cosmic rays, and although it was not very successful as a research topic because he really didn't understand it, nevertheless, it introduced me to modern physics, so that was very good. And I actually went to Melbourne to get some assistance from someone at the physics department sent me to Melbourne to get some assistance from someone in the physics department in Melbourne. And so certainly that was, I don't know, would have been only about 20% of the course, I would have said.
Now, the trip to Melbourne, that would have been by the express, I suppose, by train?
Yes, yes. Mm.
Now, was that a useful time?
It was very useful. The business of going to the university was extremely useful. I don't think I could have done it without that trip because there was no one in Adelaide who could help.
Was the University of Melbourne in those times a similar feel to Adelaide?
I think so, yes. Mm-hmm. But I had the feeling that in physics it was a bit more, a bit ahead of Adelaide, you know. It was more research-oriented, I think. That was the feeling I had. but not really based on anything very solid except my own experiences with this. There was this cosmic ray group there, and so they certainly helped me.